Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. I'm Sam Moores and with us this week we have Johnny Cocker. Hello.
Hello, it's good to be back.
Yeah, welcome back. Johnny, can you tell us like short little description of sort of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I mean, long story short, I suppose I've always had a crazy passion for cars. That extended into a pretty unique and amazing opportunity to race cars for a long period of time, just over 20 years. Starting when I was 14. And then back in 2014, I started the company JCR, which essentially is trying to bring the motorsport side of, you know, engineering, thought processes, testing, technology into the road car arena. So in the aftermarket. So that's what we've been focusing on since 2014, more and more so. I competed last time professionally in 2019. So, you know, the last few years has been absolutely full steam ahead on JCR. Yeah. And I suppose that's where the kind of evolution's come.
Yeah. So you came on the podcast a while ago. So for those that are interested in Johnny's background, we talked a lot about all this, some of the cool things he's raced and a bit about racing and I think sort of almost like how to get into it and sponsorships and difficulties and yada yada yada, lots of stuff like that. Go back, search back, and you'll find the podcast where we cover a lot of that. But I wanted to get Johnny back on because I realized it had been a long time, and he always posts on Instagram pictures of some cool Porsche wanging around a track somewhere, and I'm like, oh, that looks quite cool. What are you up to? So last time you came on, it was March 2021. I imagine things have evolved a little bit since then. I don't know, 2021, we were sort of, was that, I can't even remember when the pandemic sort of, it's not,
I don't know. Over? The last 3 years have been a bit of a blur, to be honest.
Well, I remember talking quite a bit about, we talked about a bit about my RS, but you had a 718 GT4 at the time. That you were doing, you'd done exhaust, and then you were doing a bunch of bits and pieces for to make it more sort of track ready.
Yeah, able, sure.
More fun, I guess. But you've moved on, and you've done quite a lot more cars and stuff since then.
Yeah.
You talk me through how much have things sort of changed?
Yeah, I mean, nothing's changed, I suppose, in the approach that we take with all the tuning side of things. You know, I'm a true believer in put the parts on the car, stick the car on track and go and test them. You know, that's the kind of approach that we take rather than a, you know, just necessarily if we want to tune a car. We want to change some parts on a car and prove that they work. Then I think there's far more weight in the results that you would kind of establish from on-track performance and real-world acceleration figures and lap times than there is, you know, sticking it on a dyno in a room and trying to come up with a figure here or there. So I suppose all the things that we are doing are very much kind of focused on real world. And I say real world because that's kind of where it is, you know, that's where you're going to feel the benefits is on the road, on the track. So back in 2021, obviously you just mentioned we had the 718 GT4. We're doing a huge kind of program on that car, which we completed the back end of 2021. Since then, we've had a number of cars, but it's actually funny that we picked up our 718 GT4 PDK car just a couple of months ago, which is our kind of version two. Which kind of is a kind of a nice kind of full circle. But in the meantime, we had 992 Turbo S. We developed a range of exhaust products for that, which are also cross-compatible on all the 992 Carrera models as well. Obviously, that's a little bit different because it's a turbocharged car. So, you know, the exhaust side of things are way more simple. In terms of liberating power from a turbo car, it's fairly straightforward. So we just kind of took all the nice approach, used the right materials in the right way, made sure that it sounded great, and obviously made the numbers as well, which is always important. We then had our 991 Speedster as well, which we did a full kind of track-focused build on, which is really kind of different. The idea with that was not so much that we expected to attract a load of 991 Speedster owners who wanted to go on track.
Yeah.
It was more a case of just kind of demonstrating what was possible. We could take something which is really not intended for that purpose, apply our knowledge and whatnot, and make something which actually was pretty formidable on the track as well. So that car ended up being significantly faster around a lap than, say, a stock 991.2 GT3 RS.
Really?
Yeah, even with the limited aero and whatnot. So that was a really fun exercise, a lot of learning for us, which always applies across the board into all of our different products. But that was a really cool car. That's another one which I wish I could have kept as well.
That's super cool. Was that owned by the business? Or was it someone else's car?
All those development cars are, you know, that they are true hour and hour development cars. They only get driven when they're either going to the track or going to a dyno or an event or whatnot. So they are pure kind of business use. That's the benefit of having, I suppose, that kind of, you know, being able to pull in the resources and really kind of attack something full on, you know. So we generally do one car at a time, because to be honest, that's kind of what our capabilities allow at the minute. But also I think it's good to focus our attention on just one model at a time. The Speedster was a really fun build that looked great. We did peelable paint on that car and changed it into the old classic Speedster color, Schmerner green it was actually, sorry, which is a really kind of cool different color which kind of grabs some attention as well. But yeah, the fun part of that was being able to create a build and go out there and do some lap times which were actually pretty representative of, you know, the kind of latest greatest track car from Porsche at the time.
That's quite interesting that you can get it, you know, into that sort of range. What were the sort of, what would be the sort of big wins in terms of the things that you've changed? I know you sort of changed quite a few bits, but what is the sort of order of priority in terms of, let's say, lap time?
Yeah, I think a little bit is power. We developed on that model, on the Speedster, we kind of figured out that the engine package and the exhaust package was actually going to be the same as what the 992 GT3 ended up having.
Speedster
was produced in that weird kind of period where there was all the regulation changes, Dieselgate, like there was a lot of implications off of the back of that. And Speedster and the very last few 991.2 GT3 RSs ended up being produced with an individual throttle body, engine, with particulate filters as well.
Mm.
So my figuring was that Porsche aren't going to develop a specific engine package for, you know, only a few thousand cars. It's just not going to happen. So we went really heavy into the development on that car, which was one of the reasons why we got the Speedster. We were able to develop all of our kind of 992 GT3 exhaust packages
on that car
before the GT3 had even landed. So it was, I suppose, a little bit of a kind of hope for the best situation because Porsche could have easily changed something in the meantime, but it actually worked out really well. And, you know, we took that learning straight into 992 GT3, and the transition was extremely simple. Only a few small changes, and then that all those exhaust products worked. But in terms of gains, yes, that was a gain, about 15, 20 horsepower. But the big one was the chassis stuff, really. So Porsche are really good in the sense that they build the cars almost like Lego, you know, so you can kind of recognize this part's from this model, that part's from that model. Yeah. There's a lot of cross compatibility. It's this kind of similar approach to what we take with our parts as well. So, you know, we're very much of the mindset that we'll develop an exhaust package, say, for instance, but do it in a modular fashion such that you can kind of sneak up on the overall package that you want to achieve. And a lot of the suspension components from 991 GT3 RS would actually just go straight over onto the Speedster. So we applied a lot of those parts. We installed... we've been doing quite a lot of stuff with Manti recently, but we installed Manti Racing package and the suspension side of things. We did some work to the underfloor aero, and lightweight wheels, cup to our tires. You know, it's a relatively straightforward package, really. But it was just kind of demonstrating that the capabilities of the chassis are always there. It's just a case of kind of focusing the attention in the right places. But I suppose the chassis was the big win and the tyres.
Mm. That's quite interesting that you can effectively put a Manti GT3 RS kit on a GT3.
Yeah, I mean, they say you can't, but you definitely can.
You can.
Yeah.
Because they've just come out with, fairly recently, they've done a 992 GT3 kit, which is a bit faster. I can't remember how much faster it was around the, someone else was talking about this recently. It was like, I don't know, 6 seconds a lap around the Nürburgring or something.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what that is around a normal track, not tons. But for 50,000 euros or 50,000 pounds or something like that.
Yeah.
So I guess that's their sort of, what do you get for that sort of amount of money from Manti?
I mean, you know, I suppose this leads into the next car that we did, actually. Mm. So after our Speedster, we got a GT2 RS, so 991 generation.
Yeah.
And we actually installed a full Manti Racing package onto that car. So that was a really interesting exercise, just from the point of view of understanding, you know, how these packages work. Obviously, like you say, you know, they are incredibly expensive. And I think a big part of the cost comes from the fact that, yes, they are factory Porsche. You know, our car was the first equipped car to be installed with the full kit. So that was, once this complete merger or whatever ended up happening between Porsche and Manti had completed, then all of the Manti racing kits then suddenly were available through your Porsche dealers. Through tech equipment and just almost like an aftermarket option through the dealer, fully warranted.
Yeah, so that's quite a difference.
We installed that kit on the car, did back-to-back testing to not really to verify what Manti was saying, because obviously that was quite clear that, you know, they are a real proper outfit and there's nothing that they would claim which isn't to be true. But, you know, I think that was a big part of what we learned from that package was just how things can work in harmony with one another. But also, again, from our point of view, just being able to take a Manti Racing equipped car and then make it even faster. And that was kind of our target with the 2RS. Yeah. The costs involved are huge. I mean, the package on the GT TRS was almost £90,000. And when you break it down into what components you actually get for that, you wouldn't probably even want to know how much each individual thing's costing you. But as a package, as a sum of its parts, it's, you know, it's pretty damn impressive. It's been a fun exercise with that car as well. And you know, what we did with that car was go to various circuits throughout the UK. We went to a couple of circuits in Europe as well, Spa being the main one, and actually set some lap times of our own, and ended up setting, I think it was 4 or 5 kind of lap records for a road car.
Nice.
I mean, you know, there's no Guinness Book of Records bloke stood in the corner with his clipboard, but as far as documenting the lap times, that's what we've done. Obviously, they're there to be scrutinized and or beaten. But it was just a fun exercise for us to really demonstrate how, you know, to try and put some metric to what we do. So, you know, you can take a seriously fast car, which is made even faster with a Manti kit, and then you can still make it even faster with some of our parts installed as well. And that was a really fun thing. That's been our main focus for last season.
Yeah, so let's say your home track is Silverstone, I would say. Is that right?
Yeah.
The one you go to the most. So where did you get to in terms of what was the starting GT2RS before? I presume you did pre-kit, lap time, then with kit, and then evolved after that. Where did you sort of get to, and where did you start from?
So we did as best as possible. Obviously, you know, different days, there is some variance, but for all intents and purposes, the factory car ran around about a 2:10, 2:11 lap time, which is, you know, obviously seriously quick.
That's quick.
Kind of stacks up and about where we expected it. You know, GT3 RS is around about 2:14. So in completely stock trim.
Yeah.
So obviously with all that extra power and torque, the GT2 RS being 2-3 seconds faster kind of made sense. Then with the Manti kit, we saw around about 2:08. So it was a kind of reasonable 2-second improvement, which again, in terms of what you would expect on the Delta with their lap times around the Nürburgring, obviously the ring's a bit of an odd circuit in the sense of, one, it's super long, but also the mix of corners and the length of the straights and not, you know, it's kind of, let's say, 4 times longer for argument's sake.
Yeah.
Well, 3.5 times longer than Silverstone. You would imagine around about a third of the improvement to transfer over, and that's about what we saw at Silverstone as well. Then we applied our parts. So we played around significantly with the damping, the valving of the damping, the setup, some underfloor aero. We put on some club sport parts, our own exhaust system, different brakes, and we got down to a 206.8. It was
very quick.
Yeah, I mean, it's fast for a road car. It's quick, obviously. Yeah. There's definitely more in it. You know, if we were to have the circuit to ourselves on a perfect weather condition day, brand new tyres, fresh out of the warmers, like they would on a lap time attempt, we'd probably see like a high 204. So, you know, it's seriously impressive when you consider a GT3 car back then was running, you know, kind of 2 minutes flat, high 59, something like that. So, you know, to be able to drive a car that quickly and then just literally jump in it and drive home is quite impressive. But yeah, it's just been like a really kind of fun exercise to one, be developing the parts, but two, being able to kind of just put some numbers to them and trying to present it in a different way.
Because what are the other, I'm trying to think of cars that are sort of a similar, there's nothing really like a GT2 RS from other manufacturers. Like there are, but I don't feel like any of them are actually like that fast. Obviously something like a Senna is very quick. When you did Spa, what was the, do you know what the difference was to a Senna?
We were not as quick as a Senna. I mean, you know, excuses left, right, and centre. But
oh, that's fair.
We did have serious traffic on the day. I think even with a perfect lap, again with brand new tyres, with a completely clear lap, I think it was Duncan Tappy that ran the centre around there. I think we would have probably been around about 1 to 2 seconds off. So as it was, I think we were like 3 or 4. But it's I think a Senna, I mean, they were, I think the Senna was up like 20 mile an hour down the straights. It's seriously quick in the, yeah, in the straights. But the corner speeds were very comparative. So, you know, for a 911, basically, you know, yeah, it's a 911 versus a, you know, a kind of completely bespoke hypercar to be cornering at kind of similar corner speeds.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty impressive. But I think to be able to challenge a Senna, you know, like for like around Spa, I think you'd need another 200 horsepower probably.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think they were touching almost 200 mile an hour down the straight, which is massive, yeah, you know, for anything, never mind a road car. So I think a Senna is quicker, definitely. The delta is small around Silverstone. I think the Senna time around Silverstone, nobody's got below a 207. So, again, very, very close, but I think, yeah, because the straights aren't, you know, so much of an advantage there, then it's more about the high speed corners and carrying the speed. You can kind of, the delta's a bit smaller, but either way, I mean, they're just seriously fast cars. But yeah, I think you're right. No, I don't think there's anything else out there really which I would consider to be necessarily super quick. I know Pagani did a time round Spa, which was insane, but it just looks like the car's on slicks. You know, they didn't.
I think it was.
They said they got a special tyre from Pirelli, and it's like, well, did it have any tread? Because yeah, it doesn't look like it did.
That is what we're seeing now, it seems, with like the new, I think new RS has come on a new tyre. It's like a new R. Have you, yeah, tried? Have you tried out that tyre yet? Is it? Can you get hold of it? It's like a, it's like cup two R, but N something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a little bit wider. But I know that the construction and the compound is quite different, and you can run it at a much lower pressure as well. So I think the construction is probably basically like a slick tire. I mean, the performance, yeah, that you're seeing from these cars now, you got to think like an RS. I think Bergmeister did a time round Silverstone went on one of the test drives with new tires and whatnot. I think it got down to like a 208 something. So, you know, that's not far off the times that we saw with the 2RS, yeah, but with 200 horsepower less now. So, but you could see, you know, you could see the corner speeds were, it was basically up 5 mile an hour everywhere on what I was doing. So it kind of just ties in and makes sense. I wouldn't expect that car to go any quicker than a 208, really. But hopefully we've got ours coming at the end of this year, start of next, and we'll give it a go.
That's exciting. How do you maintain, because how does that relationship with your dealer work? Because obviously you're like, well, we have to get an RS or whatever. Do you get them straight from Porsche? And they're like, yeah, no, we like, I, you, wish, guys.
No, you know, very much in the same position as everybody else. You know, it's all about relationships. I deal with Porsche Center, Sutton Coalfield, and they've been fantastic. We took the 2RS on their track day that they organized at Donington Park last year. And actually set the lap record for the road car there. We actually had like a half an hour slot at lunchtime, brand new tyres. And it was our, nice, one kind of attempt of the year where it was a true kind of, let's give it a proper go.
Yeah.
The weather was great, everything. So it worked out really well. That was fun. But now I, you know, you just need to buy loads of cars. Long story, yeah, short, yeah, there's no, yeah, special, yeah, way
spend
about
the money.
It. I know. Yeah, it's just the way it is. You know, I think you've just got to kind of nurture that relationship, and ultimately they need to be able to justify who they give the cars to. I think, you know, it goes without saying that I think the dealers want cars to go to the right people. They want the cars to be used properly. When I say that, you know, if somebody's getting a GT3 RS, I'm sure they would prefer to see it lapping Silverstone than parked up in a garage with no miles on it. You know, we did. I did more miles in the 2RS last year than I did in my road car. Yeah, because we
how
did
many,
like,
miles did you do?
Like 9,000 miles.
Bloody hell.
So, you know, nobody can accuse us of not using these cars.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And, you know, obviously the cost implication with that's huge as well, because you know, anything over 5,000 miles and people's jaws drop to the floor because they think, oh my God, he's done so many miles. But it's just one of those things, you know, I just don't see the purpose in having the cars unless you're going to drive them. I just think it's a waste of time. And I think that's almost as bad to give an allocation to somebody who's just going to park it up in a garage as it is to give it to somebody who's going to take it home, wash it and throw it out the door and make 100 grand.
Yeah.
I think, you know, hopefully the person who's buying it over is probably more likely to then take it on track and use it. So
I think the number of MR marked cars that don't get driven has got to be basically zero. I can't imagine someone putting an MR kit on a car if they didn't drive on track. Like, you just, it's quite niche.
No, I think you're right. I think there's certainly more of those cars actually get used. I mean, you only have to look at the Manti track days at Nürburgring. You know, there's like 100 cars there.
Yeah.
Most of them have got the Manti kit on. And they're there to be enjoyed. You know, I know of a few which don't get driven, but, you know, that's kind of the different owners enjoying the cars in their own unique way, isn't it? I suppose
that's right.
For me personally, I think I just couldn't have a car like that and not drive it. You know, that's where the enjoyment for me comes.
With the one of the things that people have talked about with Manti kits, that's, you know, sort of vaguely talked about on 2RS, and I'd like to hear your opinion, is you're faster around a track, but drivability goes up significantly. Have you found that generally what's happened with your changes?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and that's something which I think Manti are very much focused on that with their product. So you install a Manti kit with their base settings and their suggested settings. And I think the car is, for a non-pro driver, is probably significantly easier and therefore faster. Easier to drive and therefore faster around a lap.
Yeah.
I think for a pro driver, you know, a pro driver is going to extract the maximum potential. And realistically, the maximum potential of the car is smaller than that of the improvement in drivability. So, but that's the way that they've focused it. And that's where a big part of the gain which we achieved from the 2RS came from, you know, was focusing towards maximum lap time rather than necessarily drivability. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's something which is to be mindful of when you're installing these kits. And I think I watched a really quite interesting video the other day where they were talking to Michael Grassel, Manti Racing, and he said around the ring, the 992 GT3 kit, they're saying around about 10 to 15 seconds of improvement in an AM driver. Whereas Kevin Estra did like 4 seconds over the factory car. And that kind of difference, you know, it's kind of worth, let's say, triple the gain to an AM driver. But realistically, most of the drivers who are driving these cars are non-professional. You know, they don't have any interest in competing. It's all about fun. So if they can create a car and a package which ultimately makes the car more drivable and more fun, then, you know, and you're less likely to have an accident in it, then I think they're doing their job really well. And that's exactly where the car is focused, and you definitely feel that.
Mm. So then your car is, well, you've finished with it now, but like, it's getting to the point where it's now towards that fine line of edgier and edgier and edgier. Or is
I mean, we were running like 5.1 degrees front camber in the end. That was, you know, just absolutely to the extreme levels, you know, absolutely maximizing the package. And the car was quick, but it was knife edgy and really, really on its nose. But that's how it needs to be to extract a really, you know, kind of impressive lap time from it. That's not representative of what you would expect from a car from the factory, but then that is just settings. So, you know, it just shows the flexibility that's within the car and the chassis and the dampers, that you can just adjust the car to your liking and really extract the maximum from it. But no, I mean, it's definitely not as friendly as it was. But then it's 2-3 seconds a lot faster. That matters to us and to me for those lap times, but it probably doesn't matter much to anybody else. You know, if anything, our car is probably slower for an amateur driver to drive around a lap than the factory Manti settings, but that kind of comes full circle back around to what you just said. So, you know, it's very much, you know, you kind of, it's always a compromise ultimately with how the car ends up being set up.
Is there anything particularly about driving that car quickly that you have to think about differently versus other cars?
I mean, versus a race car, I mean, most racing cars or a GT car would be around about 500 horsepower, 550 horsepower. This was like 700 just over. Probably had double the torque of a GT3 car with less aero. So, you know, the traction control system is very good, but it had its limitations. And once you were up to a point where you were really trying to extract a lap time, it had to be off because, you know, if you get a massive torque cut on a lap, you can lose 5 mile an hour down the straight, and then that's half a second and your lap's done.
Yeah.
So we always ran the traction off. And you know, you could spin the tires in fourth or fifth gear when it's really loaded up. So, you know, when you're absolutely on the limit, you know, that's the kind of major difference really, I suppose, is although traction's incredible, it's still got loads of power and loads of torque. And it's quite, you know, the boost onset is fairly abrupt in certain gears. So, yeah, just being mindful of that. But otherwise, no, not really. I think it's just like any other kind of 911 to drive. You kind of, everybody's got their own ways of driving them, but and having them set up. But I think the main difference with that car was just the power, really. Just the fact that, you know, Silverstone, you're like 20 mile an hour up on a GT3 RS. Yeah. And in a short period of time. And also the weight, that was the big part as well, was the car's roughly around about 100 kilos heavier than the GT3 RS, but all of the additional weight is kind of on the corners of the car. You've got the turbos, the intercoolers hanging out the rear, and the additional cooling at the front. So all of your additional weight is kind of where you wouldn't necessarily want it. And the weight balance on a 2RS is even more rear bias than a 3RS. So it feels quite heavy, even though it's not. Certainly less agile than a GT3 RS. But challenging, you know, just fun to drive.
Yeah. Are you quite excited about the new RS? And I guess there will be a 2. We don't necessarily know, but I feel like someone said there's going to be a 2RS coming at
some point.
I've
heard it from a few people who theoretically should know.
Yeah.
Who say that yes, there is a 2RS. There's rumours of this, of it having a hybrid or not. I'm not sure whether that's true. I guess we'll see. But yeah, the 3RS is a different prospect. I think, you know, it'd be an exciting car to drive, but I think it'll be very much, I'm not convinced that an amateur driver would go any quicker in a new 3RS than the old 3RS because all of the lap time is in the corners.
Yeah.
So unless you're going to get off the brake and carry another 10 mile an hour, you're not going to go any quicker. So it's quite a brave kind of approach that Porsche have taken, really, because the car's got no more power.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's actually slower in the straight line than a previous generation GT3 RS. In fact, far as I've seen, a 997.2 3RS is about the quickest 3RS in the straight line there is. Certainly 4 litre.
Yeah.
Wants to get rolling just because of there's such small cars. You see how big the 992 is compared to a 997. You think about the frontal area and all the drag that you've got. So, yeah, I think it'll be an exciting car to drive, but I'm not convinced that there won't be some owners who get them and feel a bit almost disappointed because it's not just going to do a lap time and it's without asking to, you know, for it to do.
Yeah, I guess it depends who you are, isn't it? Like if you're it's the first RS in a while that I've sort of been excited about or like interested in. And the only reason is the ability to change stuff on the fly.
Like, yeah, I think that's super cool.
Like, all that stuff, change your suspension settings, diff, whatever. Like I would play with that.
Yeah.
Like in the lap. Whereas, like, I'm going to go back to the pits and, like, I might do. But, like, it's a lot more effort.
I'd rather just go and have a coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Like, get some, try and get it right, and then just carry on with your day. Does that interest you, or are you sort of like, well, we kind of just set up our cars right anyway?
No, I think in terms of obviously the flexibility and being able to adjust. I mean, you reach a point in the setup, obviously, where essentially, you know, you kind of go to a track and you're pretty much 95% there. And the adjustment in the damper allows you, in my opinion, to adjust for weather conditions, specific tracks. You know, Silverstone tends to be a little bit understeery, whereas somewhere like Alton Park, you might want to just dial in a little bit of understeer into the car just for safety. So all that kind of stuff in terms of being able to adjust dampers, obviously that's something which we've been able to do on all of our cars because we've always had adjustable dampers on them. You would only ever really adjust them just to suit the day and suit the tyre and the weather. Whereas now, I suppose, you can do that much more easily, and you can also play with the diff. And that's the one thing which I think is more interesting.
Yeah.
Is a way that you can adjust the way that the car enters the corner rather than just once it's in the corner. And that's something which would be really cool to play around with. Obviously, you know, there's limitations to those adjustments because I think they've got to probably make sure that if you've got the car set up to have maximum diff on entry, so it's loose on the rear, and then full stiff rear suspension, full soft front suspension, the car still needs to be safe. So yeah. Obviously there's only probably quite narrow parameters that they're working with it. But I think in terms of enjoyment, it brings a new thing to the table. You know, you can kind of play with the car throughout the day. I think it, in terms of from a track day driver's point of view, it's fun because you're learning the way the car works. You can try something and feel the difference and easily revert back. Whereas, like you say, you know, if you have to get it up on the jacks and start fiddling and changing suspension with physical clicks on the damper, I think you're probably less likely to actually play around with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems to sort of, I think a lot of people will enjoy playing with it, but it's almost like, depending on where you are in your track racing journey or whatever, it's like, if you're at the beginning, nah, it's not going to be useful at all. You're not going to get it. Like, you'll play with it, but you're not learning anything. Then you learn a lot and it will be useful. And then you might start racing and it'll be useful. But then probably if you start taking racing quite seriously, you're not driving your GT3 RS on track anymore. Like, you might do, but you're not really. You're probably just going to drive a race car, at which point you're out of that sort of curve again. But it'll be interesting to see if other manufacturers, if we start to see that on other cars, like, will the next GT3 have that? I don't know.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, I think, what was it? The AMG GTR, wasn't it? Had the adjustable traction control. Like 10 settings of it, adjustable traction control, which I thought was really cool, because there's a big difference between traction control being on and traction control being off.
Yes.
And that's a big window to play with. And as much as the systems are really clever and intuitive, especially on the Porsches, you know, you can run traction on and you don't, generally speaking, get massive interventions and it feels quite natural. You know, sometimes certain conditions, you might just want to dial it down a little bit. You know, we've got an M4 CSL at the minute, which is being loaned to us by one of our good friends, and that's got adjustable traction control, and the way that works is actually really, really clever. It just feels scaled. So imagine traction on, traction off, and it's just literally like 10% less as you go down. I think it'd be cool once you start, you know, back in the LMP car, when I remember we had how much traction control intervention, and then you could also set how soon the intervention was in the wheel slip. So maybe that's like another thing which will start coming in as well. But yeah, I think it's just cool, isn't it? Road cars are getting more like race cars every time somebody brings one out. I mean, there's only so far you can go before you are basically driving a racing car on the road. But look at the Valkyrie and the MG1 and that kind of stuff. You know, they're just out and out race cars.
It's insane. Like, looking at that space, we've gone so far beyond kind of like road car. For if you're making a hypercar now, unless you're let's say you've got everyone, it seems, and then you've got Gordon Murray. And Gordon Murray's going, it's a road car, it's a road car, it's a road car. I'm going to keep banging on about the fact that it's a road car. Whereas Valkyrie, AMG One, Ferrari are still kind of making road cars. But like a Valkyrie as a proposition to drive on the road, it doesn't really, other than like a novelty factor, it looks like pretty horrific to drive on the road.
Yeah, yeah. But then I suppose that's where the compromise thing comes in. You can't have a car with over 1,000 horsepower and however many kilos of downforce, it's got some incredible number, and be able to drive it like a normal car on the road. You just can't. And even more so, you know, the Valkyrie, you have to literally change the bodywork to make it actually do the lap times around the circuit. You know, they've got the track pack, which is a completely different front clam and floor and all sorts of stuff. So it's basically a different car.
I think so you get the Valkyrie and then you get the AMR Pro. Is there a track pack on the Valkyrie as well? Or is it those?
Yeah,
the two?
As far as I understand, there's a track pack for the road car.
Okay.
Which is a completely different front end and floor and maybe rear diffuse, I don't know. You know, it's
okay.
But it's pretty significant change to then be able to kind of get your full performance from it. Because I thought it was quite interesting. I watched obviously a few of the press drives, yeah, which were recently at Bahrain with the Valkyrie, and it wasn't the numbers that it's pulling in kind of lateral G isn't actually that impressive. I mean, it's impressive and it's obviously incredibly fast, but I don't think the cornering speeds are probably much quicker than anything like anything more than a Senna or a 2RS MR on the right tyre or whatnot. All seems around that kind of level. So it'd be interesting to see when somebody sticks it on Cup 2Rs and when this track pack, if they ever kind of happens. I think it's, I don't know. I don't know enough about it to really comment, but just from an outside looking in, it surprised me that they didn't have more downforce really.
Yeah, it sounds like the, and presumably this is all, you know, whether it's your tires and the fact that it needs to be able to drive on the road and all this sort of stuff. I look at the AMR Pro and go, yeah, that, like, excusing the fact that you might buy some race car, but you kind of can't really buy a race car like that. They're not really, like, I don't know what exists that's quite like that. And that just looks awesome. And everyone that drove that, like Chris and whatever, had a whale of a time. Mm. Whereas the Valkyrie on track didn't look, it looked a bit sketch.
But I thought it was funny when you saw the Valkyrie and then the AMR Pro near it. It's a completely different car. It's like it's 50% bigger.
Yeah.
it's almost like a silhouette of a Valkyrie.
Yeah.
But then there you go. I mean, there's only so far you can go with a road car. And obviously they are absolutely pushing the limits with that Valkyrie. And it's an incredible looking thing. I'm sure it's amazing to drive, but there has to be almost a hard stop as to just how far you can go with a road car.
I feel like that's got to be the end. Like,
people probably said that when the F40 came out, didn't they? Or, you know, just look how things have moved on.
If we get, as long as everything doesn't have to be EV and we have some sort of synthetic fuels and whatever, then we'll still get that. That's apparently, I was reading something about it recently about, you know, these fuels that you make, and you can basically pick the like RON value. You just decide, because you're making it in a process, you can make like 120 or 105. You literally just pick a number. So if we're all driving on these, or for our sports cars or whatever, on these fuels that they make out of solar, hopefully, presumably engines can evolve like another step because of the fuel.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Like, yeah. It's like everything would be running on race fuel, but race fuel like plus, plus, plus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, E85 ethanol-based fuels, you know, it's a perfect example of that. And, you know, you can see they run cooler. You can run way more ignition advance, which then in turn makes them run cooler again. And overall, you just, you know, everything's just more efficient. I think if you had designed an engine around a fuel, probably much like a Formula One engine, I don't know what specific kind of octane rating F1 fuel is. It's probably not crazy high. No. But, you know, just look at the efficiency of those engines. It's something that's not talked about enough because they focus a lot, I feel, on the electrification kind of element of the powertrain. But those engines, the consumption that the power that they're outputting and the amount of fuel that they're not using is just astounding, really. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's where this crazy high efficiency comes. You know, you can kind of, it's twofold, isn't it? You're designing a fuel which is hopefully sustainable, and kind to the environment and keeps everybody happy, hopefully some people. But then also if you can start designing engines around that specific fuel as well, then the efficiency will go through the roof.
Yeah.
So like you say, I think that's exciting, isn't it? I think the EV side of things is no doubt about it. You can make an incredibly fast car, with an electric powertrain, but there's still a lot to be said for just having a combustion engine inside, and whatever the future holds in terms of, you know, the way that they're going to work in parallel and maybe range extenders and all that kind of stuff. I think that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the idea of taking today's engines, but designing them for supreme fuel.
Yeah.
And like what you can do, like, what would a sports car engine be like? Your GT2 RS will be putting out another 150 horsepower, no problem.
Yeah, I mean, it would. You know, if you were to tune the GT2 RS to run even just E85 fuel, you'd gain 100 horsepower immediately. Yeah. And it would run cooler as well. So your efficiency is going up. The life of the engine, even though it's running more power, is probably going up because heat is always the enemy. Yeah, just everything kind of carries on. So, yeah, if you were to run E85 at the same power level, then you might even find that it's more efficient as well. So, yeah, it's exciting where the future goes with this whole kind of synthetic fuel thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You don't see some cars, people talk, it gets a lot of sort of chat as like it could be the savior of the world. I think in the sort of petrolhead community. But I don't know too much. You can buy it now. I think things like Goodwood Revival and stuff like that, I think they run, a lot of those cars, they run on a synthetic fuel, and things like the Porsche Super Cup and stuff like that. Does F1?
I think F1 are going to it 2030, aren't they? That's the big like engine rule change, 2030. Yeah. I think so.
I'd be all for NA engines. NA engines and synthetic fuels. It's not happening at all.
No. I think, well, I mean, they've already said that it's going way to more, you know, the electric part of the powertrain is going to be providing more of the percentage of power. The the combustion engine's almost acting like a generator at that point. I think it's not far off. So,
yeah, yeah. You need smaller brakes. And...
But either way, that's just that's their decision to go in that direction. But yeah, I'm not hopeful of seeing V10s or V12s in an F1 car anytime soon.
I don't think so. It would be cool, but it's not going to happen. Having a little look through your website, you did a lot of low seat frames for cars.
Yeah, it's actually quite a popular product. I mean, we did seat frame lowering kits for Mark II and Mark III Focus RS and the GR Yaris. There's probably tons more that we could do, but they've been quite good products for us. I mean, just being able to provide a solution for drivers to be able to just feel a bit more connected. Essentially, the issue is that when a manufacturer does a hot version of any car, so say like Ford does a Focus RS,
yeah,
you've got to take the average kind of driver hit point, and you can only deviate from that a certain percentage when producing a car with a fixed height seat. So basically there's like a median point where the manufacturers need to set the seat to be. Otherwise, if you change it beyond that parameter, you'd actually have to go through crash testing again.
Right.
So
okay, yeah.
Obviously crash testing for a manufacturer of that scale with that number of cars and whatnot is literally probably tens, hundreds of millions. I don't know what. So they avoid that. And the downside of that is that you end up with a Focus RS where the seat is sat in,
yeah,
you know, kind of 5 foot nothing, 80-year-old granny kind of position.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work if you're, you know, I'm not, but if you're a 6 foot plus guy,
yeah,
or lady who's wanting to drive these cars comfortably, or especially on track with a helmet on, it's almost impossible. So we've kind of come up with a solution to lower the factory seat, which you can do in the aftermarket, using, you know, all the correct materials and processes to make sure that they're properly safe. And that just gives you a kind of nice solution. So on the Focuses, we're able to lower the seat, you know, kind of over 50 millimeters, which is really quite nice. Significant.
Yeah.
And then on the Yaris, around about 45 millimeters, you actually have to change the seat for that as well. There is a way to lower the factory seat, but the factory seats are so poor that I think realistically, if you bothered enough to just start changing components, then adding changing the seats at the same time is kind of a good option. So that's the route that we've gone down for that.
Yeah, it seems like both of those cars is widely talked about. But yeah, I remember getting in a Focus RS and going, seems quite high. And then Yaris, same thing. But that would make a nice difference. What else? You got that's some suspension and whatnot with the you do a height adjustable spring kit, I guess, via String Theory, the suspension setup people.
Yeah, so we did when we had ARS, there was some kind of limitations within the factory suspension, which we felt like the damper was very, very good, which it is. It's not adjustable. It doesn't necessarily need to be on a car at that kind of price point and the way that it's been used. But being able to control the way that the rear worked was really important. And we kind of quickly discovered that in the factory rear spring, as you went through its travel, the relative or the kind of dynamic spring rate actually decreased. So as the car got lower, the car actually got softer at the same time.
Right,
and that was something that we think they dialed in just from a point of view of making the car safe.
Yeah.
So you kind of send it into a corner and the rear sits and then it just continues to sit and sit and sit. And that kind of pushes into gentle understeer. So again, this kind of compromise thing. So we went to a linear rear spring. We just optimized the front spring rate and the rear as well, actually. And then just made it such that you could actually adjust the height of the platform, which would kind of allow you to dial in a little bit more rake, and then also set up the car more accurately from a corner weight point of view as well. So a relatively cheap mod, kind of working in conjunction with the factory dampers, can really kind of transform that car. it's definitely not like I've got lowering springs on my car. I've just made the car look cool. That's not really the purpose of the product. We recommend around about 15 to 20 millimeters lower than factory. It's kind of like the nice point in the suspension.
Yeah.
So we did that. And, you know, that kind of transformed the car really. And that one small thing there, optimizing what's already there, kind of tends to work really well. I think it's important for us to pick and choose our battles. You know, there's some crazy mods available for that car now. We kind of were in and out relatively quickly with that model because felt like there's certain things which could be improved upon. Seats was one big one. The suspension felt like all the ingredients were there, and that was just kind of the finishing touch. Any further than that, it just felt like, you know, it's kind of diminishing gains in terms of how much money you've got to spend versus what kind of benefit you're going to get. That felt like a kind of relatively cheap win in terms of being able to set the car up more accurately and just get rid of some of those handling characteristics, which I didn't really particularly like. But this is, you know, the aftermarket. I think everybody's got their own ideas what's good and what's not. All I can do is really just apply my knowledge and my thoughts to any of these cars and hope that people enjoy it.
Yeah, that seems like quite a good solution. When I look at it on the website without clicking on it, it's like lowering springs. And then I'm like, string three. So I feel like they know their stuff. And then when you talk about it, I'm like, that makes absolute sense. Because driving that car, I felt the same thing. Just felt like really safe, annoyingly safe, to the point where it just understeers. Like it's a fun little car. But it just sort of didn't feel like alive that much under any sort of turning.
No, and I think one of the big things as well, which that also targeted, was yes, it is safe up to a point, like any car, where the manufacturer kind of dials in this safe understeer, but you get to a point where that safe understeer turns into massive snap oversteer.
Yeah.
So if you start actually driving at the limit of the tire, then the handling characteristics actually get a little bit spooky. And I think that's adding that little layer of kind of predictability into the chassis is something that we should find important. So yeah, I suppose it must be an absolute nightmare for manufacturers being able to, you know, the guys who are in charge of deciding, yes, that is good. It's quick, it's engaging, it's fun, it's safe. All of these different things that you've got to hit, you know, it's way easier for me to just go in there and say, I want the car to be more focused for somebody who's going to use it on track. And that's what we do. I would say that's a much easier task to set out to achieve than starting from nothing and saying, this is going to please everybody, because that's impossible. But that's what I found with a lot of stuff, especially like early 991 GT3s and GT3 RSs. They're like no rake in them whatsoever, no front camber, and they're just understeered like to death until they didn't. And then all of a sudden you see people having crashes because they're all coming out of corners with loads of understeer and then getting on the power.
Yeah.
And then just little switch sides on them and off they go. So I think it must be an absolute minefield really.
It must be really hard. And I don't know whether I never really got the aftermarket, I'm going to say thing. It's not a thing. It's like a place. Obviously, there's so many different levels of stuff. For ages, I was just like, oh, yeah, you know, it's a car. It either drives great or it doesn't drive great. If it doesn't drive great, buy a different car. Like that sort of thing. But now having had more experience and had more experience of changing setup on a car and experiencing that it can be not great and go to great, and then go the other way as well. That actually, like you said, a manufacturer is not going to design a car specifically for how you want to use it every day. They might, but they're going to make it, if it's Porsche, they'll get it close to how I want to use it. But if you want to use it more on track, more of the time, you probably want a much sharper tool. Whereas like my RS is set up a little bit aggressively, not very aggressively, but like a little bit more aggressive than normal. And I quite like that. It's quite fun. But then again, I think someone else driving it might absolutely hate that and think it's not fun at all. So having these sorts of changes you can make, I think makes perfect sense, and the people will find them.
But I think that for me is that where a big kind of part of the rewarding kind of side of things comes from this, from having JCR and being able to take a, let's be honest, a GR Yaris is a brilliant car from the factory, GT3 RS, unquestionably a brilliant car from the factory, but just being able to apply our knowledge and steer it in a direction to which we prefer, and albeit, catering for a much smaller pool of people. But that's kind of where our niche is, I suppose, is for the owners who are going to use them on track, who are prepared to have a little bit of compromise and just have the car just focus in. We're taking an already brilliant product and just making it a little bit more focused. And I think that's the key thing. You drive any new car now, they're actually all pretty good. And it's rare to get to jump in a new car and think that's really terrible. I can't think of any that I've driven recently, which I think is really terrible. It might not necessarily be what you want, but you think what they've set out to achieve and where they've ended up then tends to be pretty much right. Whereas not so long ago, that wasn't the case, was it? You'd have cars which, what car did I have, which was terrible? Mark II Clio V6. That's just a terrible car. Slow, dangerous, doesn't stop, doesn't go around corners. I think you could probably make it better, but it's still going to be just slightly less terrible. I think we're kind of in a time now where cars are just generally speaking pretty damn good. And just making them a little bit more focused as to what our customers want, that's where we come in, really.
I guess like me, you're listening out for new things that are coming and whatnot and all the rumors. I sort of feel like with Porsche, and you heavily deal with Porsche, we're in a end of an era sort of time where they're going, let's make all the stuff. Let's make a bunch of crazy things or a bunch of interesting builds and whatnot. The latest one I've sort of hearing about is an ST. I don't know if you heard anything about that.
Yeah, so I think from what I've heard, it's going to be essentially a GT3 RS touring, basically. Yeah. Rumours of active rear diffuser, so they can get rid of the rear wing, but then still run similar levels of front downforce, which would be really cool. That's going to have, I don't know whether it would be manual or not. Maybe, I suppose, if it's going to be 911R replacement, that's going to be a really interesting thing and probably impossible to get.
Yeah, yeah, impossible to get. It will be interesting if that is going to be sort of what it is. It'll be interesting if they keep how much of the RS stuff they sort of keep. Like the front bonnet, like all that aero stuff and the lack of boot space. Will that make it onto a touring car? And then you kind of like, how close to an RS are you at that point? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see when it comes.
Porsche make it particularly easy for themselves because, on one hand, they're the absolute masters, in my opinion, of creating a car which fits a brief. This is our Macan S, say for example, it's slightly slower than a Macan GTS, and the Macan GTS is slightly slower than the KN Turbo, and then you cross that across all the 992 generation cars. Now they just all fit in so nicely, and especially when you consider what they've done with 718 GT4 RS, just where that fits in, it's just perfectly a little bit slower than a GT3. Around the lap, but it provides something which you know, if you want a GT, if you've got a GT3, you'd still want a GT4 RS. And I think that's where Porsche are just so good at, once you're kind of sucked into the brand, they just make all these things and you just think, oh God, I just want everything.
Yeah. It's like your traction control knob that goes from 0 to 10 with one step in each way. You're like, yeah, I could have a GT3 RS, but then I'd have a GT3 because I would drive that on the road more. I'd have a GT4 RS, but that would just be for short journeys and maybe the occasional bit of track use because it's a bit more hardcore. And like, you can split this stuff up as much as you
like. I think you just have as many as you can and just drive all of them as much as possible. But yeah, I think... all this new stuff. I mean, GT4 RS is a great example of what you just kind of mentioned there, where Porsche have thought, you know, outside looking in, certainly seems right. Well, now's the time to put a proper GT engine into a mid-engine chassis. And those cars are just brilliant. You know, just so engaging, so much fun. Like ear-shatteringly loud inside due to the way that they've done the intake arrangement, which I'm just amazed that they kind of decided that was appropriate because it's just insanely loud inside the car. But just a cool car, seriously capable, but still really engaging and fun on the road as well. So that's a really cool thing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, more of this stuff. It's just, they're all interesting. Even if you don't get to drive one, I love that they exist. Just various cool things. Cruising through your website, you see all sorts of lovely exhausts for various things. Have you done a 918 exhaust?
Yeah, we did that project recently. So some of, well, I mean, you know, obviously we're not going to sell hundreds of 918 exhaust systems. But that doesn't mean that we wouldn't approach it in the same way. So we had a customer of ours who kind of said, look, I want a proper solution for this car. What can we do? So we spent 3-4 months, I think it ended up being, in the design phase, testing, going through a few different various options. We came up with that as a solution, which we've got a modular kind of approach again, where you can replace just the cat sections on the exhaust, retaining the factory manifolds, which are already in Canel and perfectly well optimized. It's kind of no real need to change them, which again is something which I'm fully on board with. You know, I think if something's great in it and we would just basically replicate it, there's actually no reason to change it. Yeah. Not interested in making stuff just for the sake of it. So we did that. We've got a direct replacement cat section, and then a rear silencer replacement as well. So you can run either or both or combine them with the factory parts as well. But that sounds absolutely incredible. It sounds like a proper high revving V8 naturally aspirated engine with that installed. Saves a good amount of weight, makes a bit of power as well, which is always nice. But we've sold a few and they've gone all over the world. We've got one in America, one in Chile, a couple in the UK now. So it's kind of like just, you know, covering. We've got a few more. We've got one going to Japan and one going to Korea. Yeah, you just kind of like crazy where all these cars are situated and how they get used and enjoyed throughout the world. It's really cool to be able to create something new and that resonate with people all over the globe, really.
Yeah. Since the first time I've heard that engine, I just wished for this long lost Porsche mid-engine normal supercar, not hypercar, you know, the sort of 200 grand supercar that never happened, never existed. You're like, yeah, and if you put that engine in it, ooh, it would be a good thing. One that's slightly odd, it's not that odd when I look at your customer base, you've got a Centerlock wheel gun, which is surprisingly expensive, these things.
Reassuringly expensive, yeah.
Reassuringly expensive, which actually makes... And I see it has a neat sort of attachment to it that stops your wheel spinning and then therefore you can tighten up the wheels. But I have had this issue where I don't know whether I'm quite ready to buy the wheel gun yet, but I own one of the big bars that I sometimes put in the car if I'm going to go and get some wheels changed or something. And that is a real problem if you've got centre locks. It's a pain in the butt.
Yeah, I mean, that tool is something which, quite honestly, has changed our lives. I think we, you know, obviously when we've had a lot of our cars have got centre locks. Our GT4, yeah, which we've got now, we've actually just put a 4RS centre lock conversion. We kind of developed using some of the factory parts and some of our own, such that you can convert your GT4 or Spider or whatnot into centre locks, should you wish. But the wheel gun is produced by a company called High Torque, who are kind of completely focused on really, really high-end precision tools. So, as you know, with the Porsche factory centre locks, you can't use an impact gun or anything like that, because they need to be tightened up in a really kind of specific fashion. So that wheel gun essentially, and the reaction arm which it's got, basically is a brace against the spokes, such that it can undo and tighten the wheel up without you having to apply the brakes or do anything special. It literally does the whole procedure. So you have a loosen function, which removes the wheel nut, as you'd imagine, and then a tighten function, which torques up the wheel nut to 600 newton meters, releases it 60 degrees, and then retorques it, and then releases the reaction arm. So it's essentially means that you can, on your own, change a set of wheels in maybe like 10, 15 minutes, which for anybody who's got centre locks and has tried to do that on their own, that's not a 10-minute job. So no. It's a really, really cool thing. We've kind of further developed it with our own reaction arm, which allows you to use the car or use the wheel gun with centre locks on various different models, including cars with a Manti rear aero disc, which ordinarily their kind of factory reaction arm would interfere with the carbon disc on the wheel. So we've made a bit of a few kind of alterations in that sense. But they've been a fantastic company to work with. We saw quite a few of them. They're really, you know, it's, I think if you understand the problem that you face with centre locks and then see that gun in action, then the price makes a lot more sense. It is seriously expensive, but the tools that they normally produce are, you know, 10 times that, because they're getting used to put nuclear power stations together, not take wheels off a car. So I think it originally kind of came from the fact that the owner or one of the owners of the company had a GT3 RS and was frustrated with the way that they were having to kind of use a six foot long bar to take the wheels off, when actually they could create a really nice solution. So that's what they did, and then we jumped on board with them, and that's been a really cool thing. But we take it to every track day. We saw quite a few to dealers, to Porsche specialists as well, who obviously you can imagine, if you've got a one-man band kind of scenario and you're having to brace the brake pedal against the seat, put the car in gear, do this, you'd like dragging it off the ramp because you're having to apply so much force to it, then this gun's just changed a lot of people's kind of perspective on actually how approachable and easy it is to have a car with centre locks.
Yeah, it's like initial outlay, but like you said, for someone that's working on Porsches, I imagine someone like, you know, RPM or someone that's seeing JZM, whatever, loads of cars, loads of centre locks all the time, you don't need to use two people. And I've never done it on a ramp, but yeah, I can't imagine trying to do that process on a ramp. That is absolutely painful.
Yeah, it's just a nightmare. It really is. And it kind of takes the fun out of the fact that you've got centre locks. Whereas that just completely kind of changes the outlook on it. And it means that you can really, you know, I mean, we did our Spa track there. We took two sets of wheels with us, and we were changing wheels throughout the 2 days that we were there, because the weather, obviously, it was Spa, so it was raining, dry. And we were just flicking between sets like it was nothing, because it's just so easy. You jack up the rear of the car, you do one side at a time. It's literally a 5-minute job. And also, you know that they are right, because the way that the gun works, the calibration on it's just incredible. I mean, we used ours for around about a year before we even sold one, because like with anything we do, even though that was a tried and tested product, you know, if we're going to sell it on our website, or I'm going to get behind something that is not necessarily our product start to finish,
yeah,
then we need to be absolutely sure that it does what it says on the tin, and, you know, nothing but impressed with it. Even down to the battery, you know, you can charge it once and you can do like 5-6 weeks worth of wheels changes on one charge, which is just nice. I don't know why you would need to do that, but it's just quite handy, really.
Yeah. Like, if you forget to charge it, you're probably okay.
Yeah.
That is a funny one. What do you run as your sort of, so presumably do you run Cup 2, let's say, on the, do you still have the GT2 RS?
Yeah, still got the GT2, yeah. Yeah.
And so you got, have you done, so you did all 992 stuff, you did actually on the Speedster because it was pretty similar, and then presumably checked it or whatever.
Yeah. So exhaust kind of side of things we did on the Speedster. And then, the Carrera and Turbo 992 stuff we did in our Turbo S.
Hmm. What was that like? I've not driven one of them.
Incredibly fast. Surprisingly fast. Best road car I think I've probably ever had. In terms of a car which does it all, I think, I mean, our car had lightweight packs, so it had buckets and no rear seats, but I think if you had a Turbo S with fold-in seats and rear seats and you got a decent sized boot in the front, and, you know, I don't think you could ever wish to have a better everyday car really than that. You know, if you could have one car that did it all, track days, GT long drives, driving through Europe, whatever, all weather driving, I think a 992 Turbo S is just unbelievably good. And incredibly capable as well. You know, we did I think it was 212 around Silverstone, so it was only a couple of seconds off a 2RS.
Yeah.
Admittedly, that was with our exhaust and Cup 2 tyres on it. So, you know, with a proper tyre, the car really comes to life, but it's very heavy though, and it feels that, and it really goes through the tyres. But, you know, if you want to wind it up and do a lap time, then it's super capable.
It's there. There, pull the skids and whatnot. When you're running, you're saying you're running two sets of tyres for sort of dry, wet spar or whatever. What's your wet tyre? Is it like 4S or something?
4S, yeah. It's just, that tyre is just mind-blowingly good. You know, on the 2RS with the Pilot Sport 4S installed, it didn't feel that dissimilar to GT3 car on wets. Honestly, I was shocked just how good it was. Because it's still got proper support and it still feels like a track focused tire, but as long as you can keep the temperatures down, then it's super, super capable. So that's our kind of like preferred wet tire.
Yeah.
It just does it all. And that's what, generally speaking, we'd run on the road. So if we were driving to Spa, we'd have 4S's on it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's been a swap that I've sort of wanted to do on my RS for ever. It's just put 4S's on it rather than, I don't know whether you can get them. Can you now get 4S's in like wide? Although probably not in 19. I don't know.
You can't. For the 991 generation cars, they now do, and the 718, they do an N-marked 4S in the proper sizes. So maybe the 997 now.
Yeah, maybe. I'm keen to do it. Again, and you can always run like a bit narrower or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised actually that a 4S out of the pit lane for the first lap is as quick as a Cup 2, pretty much. On the second lap, it just starts to get a bit warm, but it's probably not massively different. But in the rain, I mean, just forget it. You know, 4S is gone.
Yeah. My first.
So as far as a road car tyre is concerned, you're never really getting that much temperature in the tyre. So I think even as an everyday road car tyre, it is definitely better than a Cup 2. I mean, this CSL that we've got at the minute is on Cup 2 R's, and it is just absolutely lethal, you know, until you've got a decent amount of temperature in the tyres. And that couldn't be further away from safe or friendly.
Yeah.
It certainly makes it feel an event to drive, but I'm not sure you necessarily need that, you know, when you just nip into work.
In the wrong way.
Yeah.
Yeah, running tyres like that, like, yeah, I've driven around when it's cold, and you're like, no, it's just, like, it's kind of fun, but it's also really sketchy.
Yeah.
Like, no need.
You have to pick your battles a little bit, don't you, really?
Exactly, exactly. So I normally wrap these up with five questions, but you've been on the podcast before, so I'll axe most of them and hit you with one or two.
Okay.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment?
Undervalued?
Tricky.
Tricky one. I definitely can't afford any of them. I would say probably the next thing to go mad would be something like, actually, SF90. I feel like...
Interesting.
That's underloved and undervalued. I'm surprised how their values have really come down to actually not much more than like an F8 or something like that. No. Really, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
You know, 1,000 horsepower, four-wheel drive, hybrid Ferrari. I just think that's got £1 million written all over it, hasn't it? I don't think they probably will end up going back to that. But, you know, I just think that that's actually quite a cool car for the money.
That is quite an interesting one, actually. I'd not thought about that, but I did a TikTok post, which was like some me talking to Sam Fain, seen through glass, about this, about the SF90. And I think a lot of people in America, I think a lot of younger people, and also just everyone in America, they love it. It's like the coolest, it's 1,000 horsepower Ferrari. You're like, fair play. But here, everyone's like, yeah, whatever. And that's kind of a little bit how I feel about it. I'm like, why did you not just get a 296? I know it didn't exist when it came out, but why would you not get a 296?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have one, but I just think that what you kind of get for your money is pretty impressive, really, when you consider, you know, how much is the new Aventador replacement going to be?
Yeah.
That's going to be the best part of 400 grand, has to be, doesn't it? So, yeah. But then that's a similar kind of proposition, isn't it? Four-wheel drive, hybrid, you know,
V12.
Quite cool. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that. I would have said Carrera GT not so long ago, but they're already gone astronomical, haven't they?
Yeah,
that ship sailed.
It's gone. Most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you Googling? What are you looking at?
New GT3 RS, I think. You know, that's what our sights are set on. I think it's a really brave kind of decision from Porsche to go that extreme on a road car.
Yeah.
You know, when you think back to 996, 997 generation cars, you know, you could easily run a GT3 RS on the road every day. Yeah. Whereas I think this new one, you probably couldn't really. It's got absolutely no luggage space. It looks ridiculous. You know, it's probably going to scrape on the ground everywhere you take it. It's probably quite uncomfortable. But I just think that's cool. And I think it kind of circles back around to, you know, you'd have a GT3 RS, but you'd also have a KN and this and that and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, all the other ones. I heard that if you put it in track mode, which I think you have to put it in track mode before you can change the dials. If you put it in track mode and then put the dampers and stuff down to the softest setting, it's softer than a GT3.
Yeah, I mean, that would be really cool, wouldn't it? I can believe it as well with that adjustability.
Yeah, which would be, that's quite an interesting concept. That had made me think about the GT3. Next GT3, if it has that damper stuff, let's make it a bit softer on the road, please. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And then ramp it up for track. Yeah. Okay, cool. Right. Five car garage. Final question.
Wow.
Unlimited value.
918, for sure. I think especially with what we've done, you know, in the last kind of few months with this exhaust development, I've driven the car quite a bit on track and on the road, and it's just still phenomenal. I know they're big money, but I think they're probably still actually relatively undervalued, I would say, when you think what LaFerrari's done and P1 as well. I think the 918
is Carrera GT and like all this other stuff is starting to sort of go above / the same.
Yeah, so I think definitely 918 is the kind of ultimate kind of a hypercar contingent, GT3 RS and a GT2 RS, because I just think they're just such different propositions.
That's the Porsche nut in you saying that. Anyone looking
These are all going to be Porsches, just so you know.
But like someone from the outside would be like, right, yeah, so you've got two extreme Porsches.
So we've got 918, 3 RS, new 3 RS, 2RS.
Yeah.
K and GT. We've got ours arriving any day now. I think that's got to be the ultimate daily. I just think it's cool. And it's Porsche.
It's cool. Is it not? No, it's a cool. That's a cool thing to have. Is it not just going to be a bit extreme? I feel like these extreme versions of SUVs are always, the ride quality is always rubbish.
Yeah, it's surprising. I mean, it's firm, definitely. Mm. It's definitely not an S-Class. But then I think even for the car which I'm using day to day, I think I still want it to be engaging to a certain point. I think that's kind of the sweet spot for me.
Cool.
And then the last one, I really don't know, you know, maybe just that new Singer DLS. Mm. I think that's just ultimate cool, isn't it? What they're doing with their stuff and just having that kind of modern tech mixed with old school cool kind of looks and kind of feel, I think that's just ultimate. You know, if you were to just go and drive down to the south of France or something like that, that's got to be up there in terms of one of the best propositions.
Yeah. I think that garage would suit me pretty well. I'd probably swap your Cayenne for a Panamera Turbo S or Taycan or something. But other than that, I'd be pretty happy. great. Well, thanks very much for coming back on the podcast. It's good to see
you. It's been fun to have a chat.
Yeah, and I will have to come and visit you and see some of the stuff that's going on at some point.
Yeah, you should. I mean, we're on track a lot. We've got 20 odd days planned for this year, with our first one being this Saturday, actually.
Oh, nice.
So that's our first track day, which we've been kind of preparing our car. We've had a bit of a blog build series on the website and on some of the forums, kind of documenting the build of the car up to that point, and then we'll also follow the development of the car throughout the year. So our first track day on Saturday, it's due to rain a lot, so that'll be interesting. But nevertheless, it'll be fun to get the new car out there and start work on that as well.
Is this going to be this is the with the GT4?
Yeah, new GT4 PDK. Yeah,
that is quite an interesting sort of change, because the gearing on those is shorter, isn't it?
It's a little bit improved. It's definitely better than the manual car, and I think that mixed with the way that the PDK feels, the car just feels more grown up. I don't know how else to describe it, but it feels more like a proper little baby GT car now. I think the PDK really, really suits that chassis. It just feels just really together. The final drive ratios that they did on the GT4 RS are much more extreme again. So that they're a lot closer together, a lot shorter geared.
Right.
So there's definitely room for improvement there. But again, it just depends, you know, that's just, again, Porsche doing what they do best in terms of just making sure that everything stays in its line.
In its lane, yeah. Cool. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks
for coming on.
Been really cool.
Good chat.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.